Al Jazeera Podcasts.
A wasteland of rubble. The UN says clearing the debris from Israel's war on Gaza will be a huge challenge that could take 14 years. And exploded munitions will also make this a dangerous task. So what will this mean for the millions of Palestinians who hope to return to their homes? I'm Fully Batibo, and you're listening to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyze, and help define major global stories. Let's now bring in our guests for today's show. In Geneva, we have Jonathan Guthrie, Director of Operations at the Norwegian People's Aid. In Amman, Federico Desi, Middle East Director at the NGO Humanity and Inclusion. And in Ramallah, in the occupied West Bank, Raja Khalidi, Director General of the Palestine Economic Policy Research Institute. Gentlemen, a warm welcome to you all. Thank you for joining us on Inside Story. Federico, in Amman, let me start with you because you were in Gaza just last month in March. Prior to October 7th, how many unexploded munitions would you expect to find in Gaza? And how much has the danger posed by these weapons increased since the start of the war on October 7th?
I think, well, before October 7th, the number of ammunition was relatively low. I think, of course, there have been several wars and offensives in Gaza before this one, but they were on a smaller scale. The second largest one was in 2014, and that caused the extensive destruction, but still we estimated the number of unexploded ordnance that will be present at the end of this current war will be probably be between 5 and 10 times higher than what we could see in 2014 and then the aftermath.
Yeah. Will it be possible, you think, to know the full extent of the contamination caused by the current conflict?
It's very difficult to have perfect estimates. I mean, we have a working assumption that there's been something between 50,000 and 100,000 bombs dropped on Gaza and shells dropped on Gaza over the past 6-7 months. And the number is growing by the day, unfortunately, until a ceasefire will be placed. And then between 9% and 14%, those are the technical estimates of these bombs, didn't go off. Yeah. So potentially we're talking about several thousand, potentially up to 10,000 or a bit more of unexploded bombs and shells and mortar rounds right. In Gaza.
Briefly, Federico, before I bring in Jonathan, you were in Gaza last month, as I mentioned. What did you witness while you were there? What was the situation? Because, of course, we describe it. We see the pictures on television on a daily basis. But how did you imagine that it would be as bad as we see it on our screens?
It's the worst situation I've seen in 18 years of humanitarian career. And there are two kinds of areas in Gaza. There are areas that are flattened, where like most buildings have been damaged or destroyed, and there is an exploded ordnance under the rubble and also lying in the streets and empty terrains. And then you have those areas that have been targeted less intensively, where most of the population is now regrouping, you know, Rafah and the coast of Rafah, Khan Yunis in the middle area, where there are hundreds of thousands of people crammed into tented settlements or camps along the beach, and then schools that have been turned into shelters. And still you see many buildings flattened or damaged by airstrikes, because airstrikes are happening everywhere, even in those areas where the population has fled.
Indeed, the airstrikes are happening even in areas which the Israelis had said were safe for the people. Jonathan, let me bring you into the conversation. You've worked extensively in Syria and Iraq and know, you know, that these weapons, these unexploded ammunitions are a huge concern, of course, for civilian population. But for a place like Gaza, with one of the highest concentration of civilians living in an area, a densely populated area, just how dangerous is it? What's the impact of these unexploded ammunitions on people who live in Gaza?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me today. I think you've hit the nail on the head when you were talking about Gaza, because of the sheer density of the bombing. And in such a small area that we have in Gaza, and we're seeing, you know, up to 50,000 explosive ordnance, especially large aircraft bombs being dropped. 90% of the munitions that have been used in Gaza have been large aircraft bombs, 1,000-pound or 2,000-pound aircraft bombs. And this can cause quite a significant threat to the local community. Yeah. You know, taking some of the lessons learned that we've seen from the Iraq and Syria conflicts is that, you know, we really need to have kind of a two-pronged approach to the response. There's a response that is required to support the rubble removal, debris removal and reconstruction, but there's also the response to supporting local civilians. And we really need to be able to educate the local civilians and communities, especially those out of camps, and provide them with the education and on the risks that these munitions pose.
Right. How do you educate, Jonathan, those civilians when they are experiencing war, when they're in the middle of a war? I mean, we've seen people even during this conflict trying to return to their homes because, you know, they want to find food and so on. Are people being warned currently as the war is ongoing on about the dangers they face?
Yes, they are. Actually, MPA is quite heavily involved in this, providing education both through the camps but also the out-of-camp population. And teaching them what explosive ordnance look like and how to respond when we find them. I think the situation that we have at the moment is there is no kind of coordinated response mechanism to respond when the local population does find these munitions. And that probably won't come into effect until the end of the conflict.
Okay. And I'll come back to you in a minute, Federico, to ask you about what you think the response should be. Raja Khalidi in Ramallah, let me bring you into the conversation now. We've seen buildings and civilian infrastructure completely destroyed in Gaza, systems of water and sanitation, housing, schools, hospitals and so on. Do you think Gaza will still be habitable when this war ends?
Well, from the first days of the war, our own research was more or less all grouped under the understanding that this war's aim was to make Gaza uninhabitable. And as an economic, monitoring the economic and social impacts, everything has just confirmed at different stages, from the domicide that we've seen to, what is it, now two-thirds of the residential stock of the north, I believe, to the, you know, weaponizing of food and starvation and epidemicide and scholasticide. We cannot, you know, keep up, really. Mm. So that's the first point. Certainly we now have a much, and I think that's, I want to just, you know, picking up from your previous speakers, you know, we started looking at 2014 as a comparator in assessing economic impact and assessing destruction. But we've since concluded and started thinking in terms of 1945 as the comparator. This is a total destruction. This is total devastation. The World Bank report on the different sectors, housing, health, education, cultural heritage, the billions that they have suffered. And the billions in some cases are half a billion dollars facilities alone. And that's like 70% of health facilities. So that sort of scale is unheard of. And I just want to also say that this question of rubble demining is extremely important. And thinking about these details is something that we need to start doing more of, because, you know, in fact, the unexploded ordnance from the last wars was a major part of Hamas's arsenal. So I'm sure that the Israelis are going to need to, you know, and this is the problem, you know, we don't want to get into a situation where we create mechanisms which prolong Israeli occupation. Mm. So the fact that there's an international concern about demining and quickly getting this ordnance out of the way so that the rubble clearance can begin, that's in itself questions of months. So time and scale of rubble removal is a huge, huge subject.
Yeah. And so then, Federico, how does the clearing even begin when the war is still going on? When you look at the destruction of the heavy infrastructure there's been, is it possible to know, first of all, the types of ammunitions that have been used and what it's going to take to clear them, what the response should look like?
Yeah, so in terms of type of ammunition, what our teams are seeing on the ground is airdropped weapons, very large MK-84, so 900 kilo bombs, And then there's a mix of tank shells, mortar rounds, and then some air-to-surface missiles, most of them of American production used by the Israeli army. What will it take to clear all these and make the Gaza Strip safe again for civilians? First of all, we need a ceasefire, because that's the only way to operate safely and reach all the areas of the Gaza Strip, especially those that have been more heavily bombed and where people have fled and would like to go back as soon as possible. Second, we need unimpeded access. We need authorizations from the Israeli authorities and from any other concerned authority to bring inside equipment and to do the work, not only of identifying the kind of weapons used and marking those weapons, which is something that our teams as Humanity and Inclusion are already doing, but hopefully in the future also be able to defuse these items, detonate them, and remove them for good. Working under the rubble will require specialized equipment, armored caterpillars or excavators, so very specialized equipment and a big effort that cannot be carried out during an active war. We need a ceasefire.
Indeed, and that ceasefire is needed. And even when there is a ceasefire, when the war stops, the issue of access is key, isn't it, Jonathan, as Federico mentioned there, accessing these areas and also getting the equipment in. Jonathan, what do you think the process should be when it comes to, you know, clearing these ammunition and these weapons from the Gaza Strip, and who should be involved?
Yeah, I think it should be a coordinated and collaborative type effort where it's a UN-led mission. It should be a UN-led coordinated mission, but using the resources that that civil society can bring. In the past, we've seen responses where we've seen construction racing ahead of mine action. We really need to bring the mine action community and experts into the planning, the assessment phases. So there needs to be experts that are attached to assessment missions when going in and looking towards how we're going to plan the reconstruction and the debris removal. And bringing in those expertise at the earliest possible stage will prevent delays in the future. So, I mean, I think we really need to have that in place. We really need to have a strong information management system in place. Mm-hmm. Again, most likely to be UN-led, so that we can really map out the contamination, map Correct. Out exactly what type of ordnance we're finding and what response is appropriate. But I would like to just echo what the previous speaker spoke about, and access is really an issue at the moment, and getting Indeed. Access, equipment, is essential, because there's not much that the mine action community can do if they don't have the appropriate equipment to be able to render safe these munitions.
Yeah, access is an issue indeed, because, I mean, we've seen that even aid hasn't been able to get to get through to the Gaza Strip, and especially in the northern areas of the Gaza Strip. Just on the humanitarian impact, Jonathan, let me ask you a little bit more, because we haven't touched on that. The types of injuries that people are sustaining as a result of these weapons that are being used, what types are they, and how just difficult is it going to treat them, not just now, but in the long term? What impact is it going to have on the civilian population of Gaza?
Yeah, it's going to have a massive impact on the civilian community within Gaza. I mean, we can talk about the physical impact, but more concerning is probably the mental health and psychological support and impact that it's going to have on them, and has already had on the people of Gaza. I mean, we really need to be addressing this, mm-hmm. And we really need to be thinking about how to support now, because people that are suffering from this kind of mental health and trauma are more likely to take risk. We'll see greater levels of risk being taken when people do return. And then that's going to actually cause more and more physical, injuries in the future as people do return. So I think that really needs to be addressed now. And then we're going to see very, very typical type of explosive injuries, which could be obviously fatal, but loss of limbs in general, burns, etc.
Right. Raja, let me come back to you and hopefully get your economic expertise on all this. Even with the war still going on in Gaza, some people are already talking and imagining reconstruction, rebuilding Gaza. There's already talk about of that. How much is it going to take? How complicated and how expensive will it be to clear Gaza? And how much global funding is there at the moment for demining efforts that we've been talking about?
Well, the demining efforts are a critical and early action that needs to be dealt with. And some of the points that were mentioned are extremely important. However, regrettably, it's probably going to cost, it's the least costly one. And perhaps, you know, in the right circumstances, something that can be dealt with relatively easily compared to the reconstruction. Now, I mean, when we talk about reconstruction, we've started talking about reconstruction. All we've been able to do as Palestinians so far is really chart the extent of damage. So the most recent World Bank report was only the first 4 months of the war. Since then, we've had terrible destruction in the center. So that was an $18.5 billion estimate, which so now we're talking closer to 2025. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the sort of numbers that only reparations and a Marshall Plan type regional international funding can handle. So that's certainly one issue. But the other issue, I think, is also the staging and the organizing of all of this. And the fact that we need to be careful that not only that UN agencies are not replaced by non-UN, let's say, players in the relief effort in the maritime corridor, for example, and other things, but also that the Palestinians are the leading the reconstruction vision. And so, you know, where do you go with the rubble? Do we use it to expand to make a new Gaza? It's extremely critical and sensitive subject, to be honest.
A very sensitive subject on who will have the authority and who will have the authority and resources to rebuild Gaza, right?
Absolutely. Well, the authority, in principle, the PA still will have that authority once it continues to reform its and prepare for this. It has a reconstruction agency. That's where it should be housed. But the World Bank will be involved. The regional donors will have to step up.
What about Israel,
Raja?
Will Israel pay?
The principle of reparations, you know, is something we have to talk about going back to 1948. If we can start with the 2023 war and pin them down on that, then the other ones might be, you know, but that's something we shouldn't forget. This is not the first time Israel has caused incalculable damage, which it never has been held responsible for compensating.
All right. Federico Inaman, your thoughts. Looking ahead to reconstruction, how big of a gap do you think there'll be between what's needed right now, given, you know, what Gaza's experienced, and the funding, the funds that will be available?
It's hard to say, as our colleague was saying, the bill keeps increasing month after month as destruction piles up. For us at Humanity Inclusion, already the priority is to address the immediate humanitarian needs now. And you were talking about injuries before. We have seen thousands of people have suffered from amputations. There are tens of thousands of people have suffered from injuries and require not just immediate surgery, but also nursing care and physiotherapy, rehabilitation, you know, sometimes weeks and months after their injury. And then looking at reconstruction, I think it's important to start planning now, but we are still far from that moment. We need, and I think the international community needs to address the root causes of this conflict. We need to make sure this conflict is the last one. If there is no real solution that creates stability and dignity for the Palestinians and security for the whole region, including Israel, then there cannot be true reconstruction, because the amount of money required will be very high. The number of years will be, you know, 5-10 years at least. And no actor or agency will invest in that unless they're sure that this is something stable. We invest now for the next 10 years, but then there's a future of peace and prosperity for Gaza and for Palestine and the region after that.
Jonathan, your thoughts. The eventual reconstruction of Gaza will no doubt be a monumental task. You know, how important will it be to have a really solid process in place, and what should be the priorities? Because rebuilding the infrastructure is important, but as we heard, treating the people also of Gaza who've experienced, who've been victims of this conflict and who've experienced really severe injuries will also be key.
Yeah, and it's going to be very difficult to prioritize. I mean, generally speaking, the international community will have allocated funding that will go to both areas. So there'll be that supports clearance and in effect that support the reconstruction, but also there'll be other sources of funding that will be directed towards supporting civilians and victims. So I think between those two and between the different funding sources, we can separate quite easily. Mm-hmm. And I think as I mentioned before, assessments are essential. And until we get access and understand the extent of the contamination, then it's very, very difficult to understand exactly how the best or what is the best approach. In traditional mine clearance, you know, we can go and do surveys, we can map out areas, and then we can have a proactive approach to clearance. And that might be the case in some parts of Gaza, but in other parts, it might be a more responsive approach. As people return, there's a response mechanism in place for what they find. It could be having educate. We will need to educate all workers. Everybody that comes back into Gaza will need to be educated on the risks that these pose. And then we can have also mine action experts that are sitting on standby or supporting reconstruction teams or rubble removal teams.
Right.
So it's going to be a combination of different approaches, I think, depending on which part of the of Gaza that we're going to be operating in.
Yeah, Jonathan, I wanted to ask you about, you know, some of the types of the weapons that have been used. And apparently they include the controversial incendiary white phosphorus, which can seep into water supplies, I understand. So the consequences of all this will be long lasting. I mean, how do you address that?
Yeah, I mean the use of incendiary weapons isn't new to conflict, but using it on this level in populated areas is quite unprecedented, and the environmental impact that it will have as it leaks, as you mentioned, leaks into water systems, etc. We'll need a completely different response, and it's something that the mine action sector hasn't really worked on in great detail previously, although there are initiatives in place at the moment that are already looking at it, and tests and trials have been conducted on how we could potentially clean water supplies from explosive residues and things. So there, again, this is just such a complex environment that we're walking into, mm-hmm. and it's unprecedented. It's something that we've never really seen before on this scale.
An unprecedented situation, no doubt. Raja Khalidi in Ramallah, I'll give you the last word. What should be the best approach? What should be the strategy for reconstruction? And what should decision makers, you think, consider when they move forward?
Well, first things first, I think, and we've already heard about some of those first things. So, I mean, there's a very logical sequence of what needs to be done this year and what can be done and what needs to be done next year and what might be possible given resources. And this year, it's about emergency relief, which is costing around $3 to $3.5 billion a year. It's about temporary shelter, which nobody has yet even started putting in place for up to a million displaced people. It's, you know, next year is about... And it's about rubble removal, hopefully starting, and these other immediate. Then you have a whole new stage next year, which is when you can perhaps that people can start building again. But even then, you need something to boost the private economy. People cannot, after this sort of trauma, mass trauma, and the lack of services, the slow return of services, cannot be expected to go back to work, you know, and do their thing. So we need a scheme, something like a universal emergency, universal basic income scheme. So at least, you know, before we start to rebuild, we need $10 billion in the next year or so. And that's, you know, even that's daunting in the lack, as everybody said, in the lack of a ceasefire, in the lack of a political process, and in the lack of Palestinians taking charge of this process and not being mortgaged to regional powers or even, you know, with all due respect, the international agencies, which have been doing a brilliant job in our absence.
Thank you, gentlemen, for a very interesting discussion. Jonathan Guthrie, Federico Desi and Raja Khalidi, thank you very much for joining us on Inside Story. This episode was produced by Gloria Wangia-Lusaus, Imogen Kimber, Maria Kranchevili, Jimmy Getahun and Romel Asuncion. Studio sound was by Alexander Chigrin. The program was edited by Zainab Badar and Joe DeFrias. Be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch every episode. Thank you for listening. Tune in on Monday for our next edition.
Coming up on The Take, former President Donald Trump takes his case to the Supreme Court. What could that mean for the upcoming presidential election? That's The Take by Al Jazeera. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.